Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Linux and Open Source News Show. I'm your host, Nick, and this is a podcast where I discuss everything that happened in the past week in the Linux, open source, privacy, and open web spaces. So for this episode, we'll start by the US suing Apple for abusing their dominant position. We also have the release of GNOME 46. We have some worrying news about Plasma's global themes, which can apparently run arbitrary code and wipe your entire hard drive if there's a bug or they have a malicious intent. We have some news about Mozilla stopping providing access to their location services, but also launching a new sort of social network. We've got more scam apps on the Snap Store. We've got Threads joining the Fediverse by opening up their platform to being federated, at least in beta, and we have a bunch of gaming-related news. So, as always, if you want to dive deeper into any of these topics, all the links I used are in the show notes. And if you want to help this show going and you want to support it, there are also plenty of links in the show notes to do just that. And if you become a Patreon supporter or a YouTube member at any tier, you will also get a daily Linux and open source news show from Monday to Friday. So, now let's get started. So, to begin with, we're going to talk about the US's Department of Justice suing Apple. It looks like they want to take a page out of the European Union's book. The EU has been hitting Apple hard on the head with their recent set of regulations, ruling that their practices on the App Store were also unfairly anti-competitive. And it looks like the US is also noticing the same pattern because they're suing Apple for anti-competitive practices as well. So, the Department of Justice claims that Apple took advantage of their dominant position, of their ecosystem, and of their monopoly of app distribution on iOS to extract more money from developers, but also from consumers. And they also argue that instead of trying to compete fairly with other innovations or other apps and other services coming to their platform, they instead imposed a series of rules and restrictions in their app store and their operating system, including, for example, preventing people from leaving by blocking cross-platform messaging apps, by limiting access to their wallet and smartwatch features on other operating systems, but also on disrupting how cloud streaming services, cloud gaming services, and apps are operating on their app store and are distributed, and also limiting access to apps that just don't want to be in the app store. In the US, you just cannot distribute an app outside of the App Store. So basically, the main complaint of the Department of Justice is that Apple implemented barriers to leaving their platform instead of competing fairly on prices and features, thus locking users in, and according to the DOJ, smothering an entire industry. And they also competed unfairly on their own App Store by according themselves more privileges than other app developers could ever hope to have. Now, of course, Apple is not having any of it. They're saying that the lawsuit threatens their identity, which they say is basically providing well-integrated hardware and software, and also that their policies are crucial to keeping their devices secure and private, which, in my opinion, is kind of nonsense, because most of the policies in question here have nothing to do with any of that. Like, preventing an application from letting people subscribe outside of the App Store or using a third-party payment processor or distributing their app outside of the App Store has virtually no bearing on security or privacy because you can still enforce rules and limitations at the OS level. So we will have to see if the US has the same capabilities as the EU to regulate Apple and to make them a bit more open to third-party apps and services, but also a bit more interoperable with other operating systems. And I would say it's even more important in the US to curb Apple's power, because in the US, the iPhone's market share is way higher than in the rest of the world. It's 60% of the smartphone market in the US, where Android has 70% of that market share worldwide. So the US is a pretty niche system where Apple has a lot more power than in the rest of the world. So it's even more important to make sure that Apple plays fair in the USA. And one might argue that Apple doesn't hold a monopoly because, well, iOS is only 60% of the market share of smartphones, which isn't necessarily a monopoly, and that's only in the US. But that's the wrong way of looking at it, because the monopoly isn't iOS, it's the App Store on iOS. On iOS, you cannot have anything other than the App Store, at least in the US. So Apple does hold a monopoly on app distribution on iOS. And iOS itself doesn't have a monopoly in the US in the smartphone market. They have a dominant position, which they definitely abused by preventing users from leaving easily, keeping the services they were used to, or interacting with these services on other platforms. It is the textbook definition of a monopoly when we're talking about the App Store, and the textbook definition of abusing your dominant position when we talk about the limitations Apple put on iOS. Whether that's part of their identity to try and provide better integrated services or whatever, doesn't matter. It's still not legal. Well, at least if the lawsuit concludes that it isn't legal. Now, you cannot really compare iOS and Android as being the same platform. They are two different markets. Android is utterly incompatible with Apple services and a lot of Apple hardware. So you have to address iOS and Android separately, and competition for applications is separate. You compete on the App Store with other apps on the App Store. Your app on the App Store doesn't compete with apps on Google Play, and your app on Google Play doesn't compete with apps on the App Store. And one might argue that with the barriers Apple put in place on iOS, iOS doesn't really compete with Android either. iOS just competes with itself. So I guess this needs to be clarified. I think the EU has the right mind, like forcing the company to open up their services. You can keep your platform, you can keep your services, you can limit certain features of your hardware to your own hardware, but you have to let other people compete on your platform, and you have to let people leave more easily, because if you don't, then you're just restricting user choice. I hope the US can reach the same kind of conclusions, but we'll have to see how this lawsuit goes. The US is generally way more, let's call it, free market than the EU. They generally let big actors and players play around with their monopolies and dominant positions a lot more than in the EU. So we'll see if that can land somewhere or not. Now, this week also saw the release of GNOME 46. I already covered it in a lot of detail in a dedicated video on my YouTube channel. So if you want to see how it looks like, all the little changes and improvements, you can go check that out. But if you just want the TLDR version, know that GNOME 46 is not a revolution of the GNOME desktop. It's a transition release. It doesn't have an enormous number of new features, but there are a few cool things in there. The main one is experimental variable refresh rate support. Now, you do have to enable it yourself using dconf, but it's like a three-click operation. And once you do that, if your monitor supports variable refresh rate, it means that the desktop can sync that refresh rate to the frame rate of the content you're playing, most likely a video game. Meaning that first, you can save some battery life by, for example, when your display is not displaying anything that moves, it goes to a very low refresh rate, which uses less battery, or when you're playing a game that has fluctuating frame rates, your display can sync to that, and so you don't have as much latency, performance problems, or screen tearing. So it's a very, very cool feature. It's not completely stable yet, but in my testing, I enabled it on my external display. It seemed to work relatively well. You also get better notifications that can now be expanded or collapsed, but it's just the first brick in more work coming to notifications. You get Nautilus finally letting you just click inside of the path bar to edit the location instead of having to press Ctrl plus L. That's a stupid thing, but finally it's there. You get verified badges for apps coming from FlatHub in GNOME software, so you know if they're official or not. You get a few revamped settings, and you get improved fractional scaling, notably when rendering fonts, because GTK now immediately scales the font to your desired scaling factor instead of scaling it to 200% and then scaling it down to, for example, 125%. Most default applications also received some updates, Nautilus being the focus here. It's got a new file transfer progress bar that is now located in the sidebar at the bottom instead of being in the toolbar. You get new options to display dates for files, either as more human legible or just numerical ways of displaying dates. You get an easier way to change folder icons straight from the properties pop-up. You get global search by default with a new button for searching only the current folder. There's a bunch of stuff like that. All the default apps also received minor updates, but nothing super noteworthy. Most of the really cool stuff GNOME is working on, though, will come for GNOME 47 and 48. There's a lot more being worked on to improve notifications further, to have a solid accessibility framework, which, as I understand it, will also be usable by other desktops. There's home directory encryption, and there are even some mockups to let background apps have interactable options. So for example, you get a three-dot menu near the background app and you can open its context menu. So this would make background apps a complete replacement for the system tray, which is actually really nice. So it is worth the upgrade. Once your distro offers you to upgrade to GNOME 46, you should do it. It's a solid update, but it's not huge. What will come next, though, with 47 or 48, looks very exciting. And in the end, the conclusion of my video was that GNOME 46 and Plasma 6 did sort of the same thing. Plasma 6 has a lot more changes and features. They were in development for a full year, after all, when GNOME 46 was only in development for 6 months. But what they aim to accomplish is establishing solid foundations for future updates, and they both manage that pretty well. And since we're talking about Plasma, we've got two main topics about that. First, there's apparently a big problem in Plasma 6, but it might also be the case in Plasma 5.27 when you're installing global themes. It looks like these themes are able to run a bunch of commands in the background, and one of those global themes seem to trigger the execution of the infamous rm-rf slash command, which will wipe a lot of stuff off of your hard drive. If you run it as root, it will delete virtually everything from the hard drive, and if you just run it as your user, it will fail to delete anything that's in the slash folder that you don't have access to, but it will definitely delete your slash home folders and everything else, thus completely wiping everything that you hold dear. Now, of course, that specific global theme was removed from the KDE store, but there might be others that have the same issue. It apparently wasn't intentional or malicious, it was just an error in how the script was parsed, which basically cut a file path after the slash, meaning that, well, it just deleted everything instead of just deleting, for example, an archive that it had downloaded through the script. But it does mean that there is a lot of work to do to have better quality control in these global themes and generally in the get new stuff part of KDE. This part has no human verification. You can upload it, it appears in there, and anyone can install it. So anyone could do anything malicious in this, or anyone could just have very badly working scripts that could destroy your entire system if you're not careful. Now, the fact that you're not installing as root will limit what it can do, but as we just shown, it doesn't mean that it's super safe. And the main issue here is that those global themes, they're not just a JSON file with a list of various other resources that are available in the get new stuff thing of KDE, downloads them, and applies them. It can actually run commands to download stuff off of the internet, unpack that, run it on your system. So when you're using that, you're giving a lot of access to virtually anything. You don't know who published that, it hasn't been reviewed, and if you don't review it yourself, then you're inviting disaster on your computer. So the KDE team is obviously aware of the problem, they already removed the problematic theme, and they will try to find ways to make all of that a bit more secure. In the meantime, you should definitely not apply global themes and instead apply each element of the theme individually without running the scripts associated with them. Or even better, you go to the GitHub or other resource page of the theme and you install it manually so you can check that you're only installing like an icon folder in your .icons folder, because that's way, way safer than relying on the current mechanism. For now, the solutions that I've seen floating around were just warnings, which already exist. They're telling you that, hey, this is not reviewed or curated in any sort of way, so be careful. But that's just not enough. When you have a system feature with a dedicated button that lets you install stuff that runs script in the background, you really need to make sure that this thing works, or you need to curb the power that these global themes can have on your system. A warning is just not enough to address this. Now, our second Plasma-related thing will be about, well, the efforts that they're making to improve on Plasma 6, because now that this release is done, they are turning to bug fixing, but also adding some new features. And so for Plasma 6.1, Dolphin is apparently a big focus, Dolphin being the file manager, if you don't know. So first, Dolphin will once again change its icon according to the accent color that you selected, something that apparently got the boot in Plasma 6 or couldn't be implemented in time. So it's gonna work just like it did in 5.27. Second, all the various bars that can appear inside the interface, like the search bar or the selection mode, will now animate instead of just appearing into existence. Again, I'm pretty sure this was already the case in 5.27, but they probably didn't have time to put that into Plasma 6. The trash and recent files will also have some special view settings by default that will always be applied to them, no matter the other view settings that you decide to apply to everything else, and Dolphin will now get a new settings page to configure the information panel and how it works, so you will have options for the various panels. For now, it's just information panel, but other potential panels that Dolphin can display might be added to that settings page later. On top of that, the Qt 6 transition also needs to be completed. Some KDE Gear apps have not been ported yet. For example, something like Color Paint, which is kind of Microsoft Paint but for KDE, KMix and KWave, which let you interact with audio files, KDevelop, which is KDE's IDE, Camoso for interacting with your webcam, K3B to burn CDs or DVDs, or KRDC, which is a remote desktop program. Some of them just need some small finishing touches, some have very complex dependencies that will require a lot more work, and so of course the KDE team is inviting anyone who would like to help with this porting effort to do so. And the reason why it's important to do it now instead of just waiting around is that, well, first, the knowledge on how to port applications from Qt 5 to Qt 6 is around. People have been doing that for the past year, so all that knowledge is really fresh. Second, it is extra heavy to pay for the storage and downloads of these older Qt 5 dependencies and old versions of Qt and the KDE frameworks, so as soon as everything is ported to KDE 6, Qt 6, then it's a lot less of a burden on KDE servers. And third, well, it just has to be done to rely on a supported version of Qt and the KDE frameworks. As the KDE team points out, future them will hate themselves for not doing it right now because they already did that when they moved from KDE 4 to KDE 5. They let a bunch of stuff slide and they ended up having big problems to fix in the long run. So now they do want to focus on doing that porting job right now, so they are done with it and they can move forward. Now, personally, I love seeing all that emulation around Plasma. Plasma 6 doesn't really feel like a different desktop if you compare it to Plasma 5, but after testing Plasma 6 for my dedicated video, going back to 5.27 was a bit annoying. There are so many small quality of life improvements in Plasma 6 that I really cannot wait to get that update on my distro, which is Tuxedo OS. They announced that they were going to offer that update, but I don't exactly know when yet. Now, there are bad news for a lot of applications that depend on location services on Linux, because Mozilla announced they would shut down access to their Mozilla Location Services, or MLS. This is a very widely used location service, used by the freedesktop.org location framework, used by GNOME Maps and GNOME Weather, and a lot more. And they will have to find something else to rely upon before June 12th, where all third-party API keys will be removed and this framework basically will no longer work. This is apparently part of the cuts that Mozilla made with their new CEO coming in. They reduced staff on certain projects that they deem not worthy of their time or investment, and apparently this was part of it. Another main reason was that Mozilla apparently had to settle a patent infringement lawsuit in 2019 for these exact services, meaning that they couldn't really invest in those MLS, they couldn't update them with new features, make them better, or even exploit that service commercially. So it is not the end of the world for applications that depend on MLS. Most of them will still support detecting your location through your IP address. But for something really accurate, the only proposed option for now has been Google Location Services, which, well, no, do not use that by default, please. I do not want any default GNOME or KDE or Linux application to transmit location data to Google by default. Anything privacy-related should never default to Google. It would be a horrible backstab for anyone who uses Linux for privacy reasons. I would much rather have imprecise location detection than having Google as a backend. And what makes this even weirder is that while they defund or remove access to Mozilla Location Services, they still announced other projects that basically don't seem like they have any potential future, Mozilla announced something called Did This. So, like, hey, I did this. It's sort of a personal blog where you can publish updates of how a project of yours is moving forward, whether it's learning to code, coding a program, crafting an object, painting something, whatever else. You can post texts and photos, you can post links and notes, and it's meant as both a record of what you've learned and what you created, but it's also an opportunity to let people know how well you're advancing on your project or learning journey. Now, Mozilla says it's not a social network, at least not yet, because everything you publish will be private by default, and you can decide, if you want, to share things with other people, but that will be in the future, mostly. They also say they don't want to move to something viral. They do want to add social features, like community-based features, but they also want to focus on what they call healthy interactions, so I would assume there would be no recommendation algorithms, no pushing things that have the most views or the most likes, or what generally makes social networks pretty toxic. Now, the app for Did This is already available for iOS right now, and there's a waiting list for Android or the web app. And why not? I mean, I could see myself using that to share progress on maybe a video I'm making, or maybe when I'm building a new thumbnail, or when I'm building or painting my Warhammer 40k minis. But why is Mozilla doing this now? Because they've cut a bunch of projects. They've cut staff for a bunch of projects, even projects that made money, like not a lot of money, but some money, Mozilla VPN, Mozilla Relay, there were money-generating services. Maybe not a lot of money, maybe they didn't even break even, but there were services generating money. What's the plan with Did This? They're cutting the useful Mozilla location services, but they're building a potential new social network after they pretty much stopped investing and developing their Mozilla.social instance, which is virtually the same thing. I don't really understand where they're going with this and what the focus is at Mozilla. Really, it's weird. Now let's talk scam apps. I already reported on one crypto scam on the App Store that was removed, but this time it is way worse. At least 10 new crypto scammy apps with the same scam purposes were now published onto the same Ubuntu Snap Store. They were all published by the same developer called Digital Safe, and they were called things like Tronlink, Uniswap, Jax Liberty, Avalanche, Trust Wallet, Electrum, and again, Exodus. And I'm assuming all of these are real names of real companies or services providing crypto wallets that basically have nothing to do with these scam apps. They were just using their names to try and promote their scammy software. So all of these were promptly removed from the Snap Store, but they popped up right after that, like a day after, published by another account called Code Shield. And Alan Pope, who is the person who already reported on the first Exodus wallet scam app, reported these applications once again, saying that, hey, you really need to fix your crap. So the apps apparently don't let you create a new wallet, they just prompt you with an error. Obviously, they want you to add an existing wallet so they can siphon everything off of that wallet. They're all just a wrapper for a web view, and so they can be published as sandboxed apps without triggering a human review on the Snap Store. And as Alan Pope says, it is trivial to push this type of app onto the App Store. Even if you remove them, they can pop back up the next day and the day after that and after that, because you can just create any email address from any service and use that to publish these apps without any human review. No action has been taken on the Snap Store to make sure that this doesn't happen again, even though there were discussions started about this. So for now, I would just not trust anything that comes from the Snap Store that is linked to finance or crypto. Now, to be fair, I wouldn't trust anything linked to crypto, period, because it's just the realm of the scams. But at least on the Snap Store, be very careful. Generally, for everything that involves your money, try to download stuff from the official websites. It's not a guarantee that something isn't a scam, but at least you're getting the real app from the real source if you do your due diligence. Even downloading stuff from FlatHub on that front, I just would not recommend, because again, there is no guarantee that this app is official unless you see the verified badge for a named wallet that you trust and already use. So be careful, the Snap Store is not as secure as they want you to believe. FlatHub probably would have the exact same problems. So yeah, for anything related to your money or financial health, just do not download from these sources. Our next topic is about Threads, which, if you don't know, is Facebook's new app that does the exact same thing as Twitter, but isn't Twitter. They now opened up Fediverse Federation in beta for users in the US, Canada, or Japan, meaning that they do have ActivityPub integration, ActivityPub being the standard used by stuff like Mastodon, PixelFed, Diaspora, and a lot of other tools, like, for example, CastoPod, the source where this exact podcast is published. So Threads will be able to interact, at least in beta, with other services from the Fediverse. Now, to use this on Threads, you need to have a public account, and it only works one way, meaning that other services are able to find your Thread account and follow it, interact with their posts, and share them. But you cannot, from Threads, follow people from the Fediverse. So from Threads, you cannot follow someone that is only on Mastodon, but someone on Mastodon can follow someone that is only on Threads. Apparently, some people also reported some issues with PixelFed not integrating well. Not sure if that's a PixelFed-related issue or a Threads-related issue. But yeah, that's now open in beta. This will obviously be a very controversial thing. Some people will like the fact that they can follow people that would have never appeared on Mastodon or any other Fediverse service, but some will be worried about an ActivityPub takeover from Meta, because Meta, just with Threads, probably has more users than the entire Fediverse, meaning that they basically have all the power over the ActivityPub standard. If they decide to extend it to add some features, other services that don't want to implement these features will be left behind and will no longer be able to interact with Threads, which will be the biggest user base on the Fediverse. So I understand why people are wary, and also we had our nice little bubble, which was pretty cool, and we were pretty much safe from the general public that is often pretty toxic. So in the end, I personally don't care about Threads joining the Fediverse. I don't plan on following anyone that isn't on Mastodon or any other Fediverse service, because I don't really need to. I already follow most people I'm interested in, and I don't think anyone on Threads would make it onto the list of people I follow. But I would also like people to be able to follow me from Threads, if that's what they use. I would never recommend anyone use Threads, because it's from Meta, it's privacy invasive, you should not touch that with a 10-foot pole. But if that's the platform you chose, then I would at least have these people have the option to follow me, because I am not leaving Mastodon for now. So if you want to follow what I post, which is not that much, then I would like people on Threads to be able to do so, if they finally add that capability, because for now, in the beta, that's not possible. Okay, now let's talk about the Mesa drivers. And Foronix had an interesting article about those, pointing out how the project has evolved from mostly a reverse engineering effort done by the community to try and get some graphical acceleration and just graphical hardware support on Linux. And it's moved from that to a complete repo of drivers. It is the main way for companies to push their graphics drivers to the Linux community in general, apart from NVIDIA. Performance is now also on par for these drivers with what you can expect in Windows. It's not just an also-ran or a hack-together thing, it's just a solid driver, and in some cases, the performance of Mesa drivers even surpasses the one that Windows can enjoy. But this all comes with more responsibilities and more work for Mesa developers and maintainers. And one of the examples here is a recent merge request, which reverted a change to force Mesa to stick to an older version of Zlib, which is one of Mesa's dependencies, because moving to a newer one would break a specific graphics benchmark that a lot of hardware vendors use. The issue lies with the benchmark itself, because it relies on an old version of Zlib, and it is not distributed in a way that would make this dependency packaged with the benchmark itself. For example, if the benchmark was packaged as a Flatpak or an app image, it could come with its own version of Zlib, and this wouldn't be an issue. But in the end, Mesa just had to accept to rely on the older version of that library. Because if the benchmark didn't work, some companies contributing to Mesa drivers would just prefer moving to something closed source that works exactly how they want it and support the software that their customers expect. And as Mesa developers pointed out, it's not a technical issue, it is a political issue. You cannot decide that something the industry relies upon just won't work anymore because they refuse to update their dependencies. It would hurt Mesa's reputation, and it would make it look inflexible and unsuitable to its partners that create hardware and the drivers that go with it. And that's just one example, but it's one that perfectly illustrates how you sort of need to change your priorities once companies get involved or once your software is used by a lot of companies. If you stick to the technical purity of the project, in the end you might hurt it because you will lose contributions or you will even lose potential jobs because those companies do employ people to contribute to those drivers as long as Mesa suits their needs. But on the other hand, if you cave in to all corporate demands, then you pretty much lose the entire control of your project and you end up with something that can significantly drift away from the initial goals. Now, in the end, I think compatibility with apps is preferable to enforcing one specific dependency in this case. Drivers are just meant to let people run software on their hardware, even if that software is badly packaged or written, or like Windows drivers would never exist because their main goal is to run Windows, which is a terrible piece of software. Now, still on drivers, if you're an NVIDIA user, there's a new version of their proprietary drivers. It's version 550.67, and it is mostly a bug fix release that fixes an issue with VKD3D, which could cause the GPU driver to hang. It also fixes an issue with ray tracing on Alan Wake 2, and it updates the NVIDIA settings control panel to add a few options in there that weren't there before. There's also a fix for Wayland that should prevent certain apps running on it from being stuck. It is still missing a very important fix for Wayland users, which is fixing the flickering in certain ex-Wayland apps for certain GPUs. And this won't be coming until version 5.55. But still, it's good to see updates to these drivers, and especially game-specific fixes. This is something NVIDIA does on Windows all the time, and it does mean that first, the proprietary NVIDIA drivers for Linux, at least on the X11 front, are good enough that there's no major new feature needing to be implemented. They can now mostly focus on fixing the latest game releases. And second, it means that NVIDIA does take Linux a bit more seriously than it once did, even Linux gaming, which is pretty niche, so that's always pretty good to see. Okay, now let's finish this episode with the gaming news. And on the gaming side, we have a few things to cover. First is Suyu. This was the first fork of Yuzu that was made available. It was a completely non-profit, it did not accept any donations to try and deter Nintendo's lawyers, and it came with a few new features compared to Yuzu. And it's already been taken down by GitLab after a DMCA takedown notice from Nintendo was sent to GitLab. Since the project was based on something that was already taken down, namely Yuzu, there was no conversation or arguing and Suyu was instantly removed. Of course, the code is probably still around somewhere. It will very likely resurface at some point, but it will have to be a bit more stealthy, which should be very hard for a project like that because we're talking about the internet and the emulation scene not sharing publicly something that they like and they use, which seems completely impossible. So thanks again, Nintendo, for sucking so hard. You're just ruining the fun of a lot of people that might even have given you money, so thanks. Now, we also saw the announcement of FSR 3.1, FSR being a Fidelity Super Resolution or something, or Fidelity FX Super Resolution. It's basically AMD's upscaling technology that lets you run a game at 1080p, but it sort of looks like it's running at 4K on a 4K display. So this new version promises less flickering and blurriness around objects in motion, also less ghosting, and better details preservation, which has been the issue with all of these upscaling technologies. On a still frame, it looks really good, but when something is moving relatively fast on screen, you can definitely see some fuzziness, some blurriness around the edges because, well, it's upscaling, so it doesn't have the right number of pixels. Another interesting thing is that FSR now decouples their frame generation features from the upscaling itself, because these technologies like DLSS and FSR can also imagine frames to go in between the ones that your game is actually rendering. So for example, you could run a game at 30 or 45 FPS, but with FSR, it would create the frames that are needed to make it look like it's running at 60. It comes with latency, of course, because these aren't really rendered frames, so the game doesn't really respond to your inputs while these frames are being displayed. But for games that don't really necessitate a super intensive, like lightning fast reactions, it can definitely be useful. And so now this means that you could use FSR for upscaling, but use another frame generation technology, for example, the one from Nvidia, which apparently is more efficient than the one from AMD. Now, Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart will be the first game supporting FSR 3.1, and judging from the animated GIF or GIF, no matter how you want to pronounce it, that they shared, it does look much better with moving objects. It's way less fuzzy. Other games that will jump on that new version are Cyberpunk 2077, Dying Light 2, Ghost of Tsushima, and also the not-yet-released Space Marine 2, which I'm very excited about because I'm a big Warhammer 40k nerd. I really like these upscaling technologies. Not only are they a good way to play a game more smoothly, because you just render it at 1080p, so you're kind of like guaranteeing your 60 FPS, but you can render it, well, you can make it look like it's 1440p, or you can render it at 1440p and run it on a 4K display. That's what I do on my SteamOS console. But also, these technologies help with keeping your hardware for longer, because newer AAA titles come with better implementations of these technologies. And if your GPU supports those, then you can keep it for longer than usual instead of having to buy a new one every time you really want to maintain that ultra-detailed 60 FPS experience. Now you can sort of do that without changing GPUs, which is kind of cool. And finally, we have news about a new Linux-based gaming OS, but this one actually has some funding behind it. It's not your also-ran distro based on Fedora or whatever, it's not Chimera OS, it's something else. It's Linux-based, of course, but it just aims to provide a controller-focused experience for people who want to build a console or to run a Windows handheld without Windows with a better operating system. Now, this one doesn't come with a desktop mode. It's not like SteamOS. There are already plenty of options to do that. This one is just focused on console-like experiences. It is developed by a company called Playtron, which apparently is also formed by the guy behind Lineage OS, and they plan to have partners to ship devices with that new OS pre-installed in 2025. They have $10 million to fund the project. Doesn't sound like much, but also they're only basing themselves on already existing technologies, and maybe they just redevelop an interface on top of what exists already, so that might be enough. And they would charge $10 per license to manufacturers and hardware partners, compared to the $80 that Windows apparently charges, meaning that OEMs could either provide cheaper devices or pocket a lot more money, which is the more likely outcome. Now, of course, as soon as Valve comes out with a program to let OEMs use SteamOS, I'm pretty sure this thing will instantly die unless it offers a really, really good experience for non-Steam games, because SteamOS does let you run non-Steam games, but it's sort of hacky, and no one in their right mind that just wants a handheld console will take the time to move into the desktop mode to install the Heroic Launcher, to add a launcher to your SteamOS page and then run that and then try to deal with the controller issues that these applications have. Like, it's a niche thing. If they can manage to build a solid interface that groups your games from GOG, from Epic, from Origin, from whatever, even if they all run with Proton, if they can manage that, then they might have a shot. If it's mostly Steam games, though, I think the moment SteamOS releases, this thing is dead. And honestly, Valve should really start doing those partnerships. They are losing a lot of momentum behind SteamOS right now. Windows 11 is still there, and it's still a horrendous experience for any handheld or console. It is not designed for controller gameplay. It is not designed for appliances that only do gaming. It has a lot more overhead than SteamOS has. So there's a big market for SteamOS to jump into. And I don't really know why Valve is waiting so long to try and do partnerships. Not even saying publish a SteamOS ISO for everyone, because that's a lot of support, potential bugs with various hardware configurations. But if they could add a paid program, like for example $10 per SteamOS install, and offer support for those specific devices, I'm pretty sure a lot of companies would jump on that bandwagon. Okay, so that's going to conclude this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. As always, if you want to dive deeper into any of these topics, all the links are in the show notes. And if you like this show and you want me to keep making it, well, you can also support it by clicking on any of the links in the show notes as well. So thanks for listening, and I guess you will hear me in the next one next week. Bye!